Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. And I'd like to ask you, are you without your reservation? What reservation are we talking about? Well, we all come from some ancestry that is likely quite ancient. And some of it is very present with us. And our guest has been on the show before and has written a book about his ancestry, his genes, and it's called Without Reservation. So we're talking about that we are living in our gene pool somewhere, and we need to know more about it and learn to treasure our ancestry. And this is Without Reservation, Awakening to Native American Spirituality and the Ways of Our Ancestors. Randy Kritkowski, welcome back to Energy Stew.
Thank you. It's great to be back on the show, Peter. Thanks so much.
And I'm so glad about your book because it really brings out the story of, for all of us, of finding out more about ourselves and treasuring the parts that we didn't know enough about. And now we can learn more about them, whether they be Native American or from any other part of the world.
Well, I think what I've learned since we last talked, and what, strangely enough, the book is teaching me as I am asked to explain it or as I turn it into an audio book, is that I actually didn't initially grasp the understanding or the depth of the message Without Reservation. In a sense, as you were alluding to a moment ago, all of us in the modern world have been uprooted and moved about and taken off our homelands. Very, very few of us live where our ancestors 3, 5, or 100 generations ago lived. So we're all trying to find our way home. And for Native Americans in particular, home is place-based, deeply place-based. We lived for millennia in the exact same place, knew the same mountains, the same rivers, the same trees. And we sincerely believe, and I think I've discovered, that they get to know us and develop relationships. They become part of our community. So when we lose those connections, deep spiritual links and a sense of our own completeness is broken. And then if we're put on a postage stamp reservation, whether it's in the Southwest, in Oklahoma, where my Potawatomi tribe is, or whether it's in a high rise in a city 1,000 or 5,000 miles from where our ancestors came from, we start recreating connections intuitively, spontaneously, and sometimes desperately. And it's part of the self-healing. And that's what I'm finding is the theme in my book that is just jumping out again and again and resonating with readers. And they're asking me, so how do we self-heal? How did Native Americans self-heal, or have they?
Yeah, there's so much wisdom that we want to draw from that isn't always available.
Well, part of the wisdom that I have come to discover, and it's strange because I worked as an environmentalist and head of an environmental organization for decades all over the world, you know, Soviet Union, China, here. Part of what I'm discovering from the indigenous perspective now is the connections to nature that are not, you know, just material and policy oriented and science oriented, but deeply, profoundly spiritual. So I'll give you an example. When I wrote in my book, I talked about going to the Montreal Botanical Garden, which I really love. We live part-time in Montreal. And I remember standing in front of a bonsai plant one day and looking at it and wanting to weep, because here is this beautiful, beautiful 100-year-old tree that's 1.5 feet tall, growing in a container with its roots separated by 1 meter from a concrete floor, and it's never to know touching the earth. And all of a sudden it just hit me, oh my God, you know, this is the story of my people and of my ancestors. And then it hit me this isn't just the story of me and my ancestors. This is the story of people I've worked with all over the world. So I began a discussion with a colleague who was studying in Germany. She's Chinese. She was born in a rural village in China. And she was doing her dissertation on urban gardening in China and in Germany. And she insisted that people who urban garden were desperately, and actually not just desperately, but actually succeeding in reconnecting with nature. And I said to her, Yang, how is this possible? You know, they're uprooted, the connection is broken. And then she explained to me a little potted plant she had on her windowsill in Germany. And she said, when she gets really lonely and really depressed and wants to reconnect with nature, she imagines herself the size of an ant living in a forest, which is the plant on her window, and she begins to feel comforted and healed. And that was the moment of awakening for me. We don't all have to go back and live in the forest like I have the luxury of doing here in Vermont. We all have to find our own paths of healing and reconnecting with nature. That's part of not just making the reservation become more humane and natural, but healing our own spirits.
It's amazing how uprooted we are. And I live in New York City. Fortunately, even while I'm talking with you, I'm looking out the window at Riverside Park and the Hudson River. So I'm very fortunate. And so many people, you know, don't have opportunity to feel part of nature.
Part of the difficulty I've also been learning in the last few weeks with various, you know, interviews and an online course seminar I'm taking with a college here in Vermont. Part of the problem is that when people look at nature, they don't see the healing, embracing, alive and vibrant nature that our ancestors see. They see nature with a modern narrative written all over it. And while the narrative is true to some degree from a scientific perspective, it's a dead end. And that narrative is the world of nature is dying. I hear again and again, you know, we're doomed, extinction is on the horizon, we're, you know, doomed as a species. So people look out and they see the trees and they see the birds, and they immediately tell themselves, oh, they're all going to die, and so are we. And some people even tell me, and we should die. Well, I can't think of a more self-defeating and self-destructive way of trying to engage with the world. So the last 2 months, I've actually spent trying to find ways of explaining to other human beings how they can find reasons for hope, and how they can find that if they go outside and actually look at the nature that they fear is about to disappear before their eyes, and how important it is for them to take their children out and let them to see nature healing. I mean, a simple thing like moss growing between the cracks in the sidewalk, or those dandelions that break up through asphalt in the middle of a giant mall parking lot. There's something powerful in nature that won't give up as easily as we seem to be sometimes giving up.
When I was a kid, I would go up into New England in the summers, up in pretty far north in New Hampshire, and where there's great forests, and it felt like the world was almost all forest and all wilderness. And we just had our little settlements here and there, but we really are a planet of nature.
Yes. When I worked in the Soviet Union, it was still the Soviet Union in the late 1980s and early 1990s, there was a very famous book written. It was called Ecocide. And the book became kind of the Bible for environmentalists working there. And unfortunately, it became the founding document for US government and US foundations policy in the Soviet Union. The idea was the Russians, the Soviets, we called them the Russians, had succeeded in virtually killing nature. And if we didn't stop what they were doing and help them to reverse course, they were going to exterminate everything within their boundaries. And then in the midst of doing this work, I had an opportunity to fly from Russia to Beijing over the great expanse of Siberia. And for hours and hours and hours, I sat in a plane and I looked down at green, 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 lakes, green, some white snow, green, green, green. And suddenly it hit me. Yes, they've damaged huge parts of the ecosystem that is under their stewardship, but they have not killed it. Now, I know there are those out there right now who would say, oh yes, but have you read about what's going on in the taiga? It's melting and it's caving in. This is true. There are patches of horrible disruption, but the system that we call Gaia is a living system and it is not dead. Wounded? Yes, not dead, not about to die. And we don't give up on our Mother Earth when she's on the gurney in the emergency room. We do everything we can to heal her, especially when she reaches out and wants to be healed and is far, far, far from nearing the end.
I had a great experience of that when I was a kid. We used to go to summer camp sometimes up in New Hampshire, but there was one in Massachusetts that I spent a few years at. And it was a real big, nice camp with lots of cabins and playing fields and basketball courts and tennis courts, et cetera, and big mess halls. And after I left, it was about 60 years ago, I left and the camp closed down and no one set foot on those grounds again for 30 or 40 years. And that's when I went to visit it later on, and trees were growing through the cabins and nature was reclaiming the whole place. It was amazing how little of the camp still was recognizable. And I'd love to see how powerful that was.
I had the same experience some decades ago when my family and I visited the region around Chernobyl. And this is before it settled down and became a theme park. This is like, you know, the years immediately after the accident, maybe 3 to 4 years. And the Ukrainian and the Belarusian government had built this giant triple ring of chain link fences around the reactor. We drove all the way into the final chain link fence. It was a bit foolhardy, I have to say, in retrospect, but we could see the reactor that hadn't been covered over by the sarcophagus. But as we drove through each zone and they opened a gate for us to go deeper and deeper into the contaminated zone, and it was, you know, still clicking lively on the Geiger counter, in fact, more intensely as we got close to the reactor. But the strangest thing, exactly as you just said, there were hawks and eagles and wolves and all kinds of wildlife. It was like being in the middle of a nature preserve. And the really, really sad thing is there were human beings living in there. They had moved from Chechnya, where there was a civil war going on, and they were farming. And what they told us was, we'd rather come and die here slowly of radiation in this beautiful nature than we would to be at home and die suddenly with some kind of bomb or explosion or attack. So they had made a choice to spend their lives in the midst of an embracing nature, even if it was a nature that had the potential of doing harm. And that's kind of where we are right now with this pandemic. You know, we're wanting to embrace nature, and at the same time, nature is sending us a very humbling message with its smallest creatures, saying, you are not quite so dominant as you think you are.
But this might be something called hormesis. And I've learned about that, about radiation hormesis, that, for instance, in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there were, in the immediate area of the explosion, everything died off. But there was a ring around it that the people who survived in that ring lived to be older than people who were even farther away from it.
Interesting.
So they received a Hormosis level of radiation that actually made them healthier. So there is a certain level that radiation is good for you, and then it can be too good, I mean, too bad and harmful. But I think what you just brought to my attention is that maybe this whole experience now is that kind of hormesis, which will make us stronger. It won't kill us off, but we're becoming more immune to hardship because we're learning from it.
It's a beautiful analogy, and the very thought you just expressed more succinctly than I've been able to in recent days has been percolating through my brain. Some people have told me that the virus is sent as, you know, Mother Nature's punishment, but I rather like your explanation. And I do think, in an inconsistent one step forward, one half step backward way, we are learning from this pandemic, and the lessons are lessons that have been long overdue for us to come to terms with. The first one I keep mentioning is humility. You know, we don't control our own world and society and economy as much as we would like to think. We certainly don't control all of the realm of nature as much as we would like to think, or as much as some people fear we do. So, you know, we're having to step back and say, so how do we discover our real place in this larger equation? How do we assume a more healing and helpful role? And that's when I look into what I read about years ago in the field of quantum physics. I certainly wouldn't want to try to give a brief lesson in it. I'm not a physicist, but I've been reading up again in the last few days on DNA, which goes back to what you were talking about with exposure to radiation. Everybody thinks of DNA as this, you know, fragile double helix, which when exposed to radiation just, you know, falls apart and is damaged, and we have mutations that cause cancer and we die. But what it turns out to be the case, and you know, people have been studying this, I guess, for a few generations now, that DNA is the most remarkably consistent self-preserving and self-creating and healing molecule that you can imagine. If physicists looked at it in a purely mathematical way, they would say that pieces of the molecule should be breaking, you know, once every X number of times, you know, we replicate our DNA. But in fact, it's a tiny, tiny fraction of what happens with natural molecular disintegration or atomic half-lives. And the reason is that the DNA molecule has its own ability to find damaged genes, clip them out, replace them with healed genes. Mm. So it's vibrant. And in a sense, I think that's a metaphor for the system that Lovejoy called Gaia, which is this living organism of the earth. I think it has its own self-healing capacity, its ability to find weak points, clip them out, insert new points, and self-heal. We need to find those pathways to self-healing and get on board.
Right. It needs to be within ourselves. We can recognize ourselves as healing beings who can restore what we've lost and even do a better job. And one thing I was recognizing while you were talking is that the environment, because of the lockdown, is cleaner. It's healthier looking than it ever has been in our time. And it can create hope. It's like, oh, I thought it was all lost. I thought we'd never see those mountains again. And there they are. So let's try to maintain that.
The same thing happened with the tragedy of 9/11 when planes didn't fly for several weeks and suddenly the skies cleared and people who study solar radiation on photovoltaics all over the world saw these huge spikes in photovoltaic activity, more than they had ever even begun to factor into their equations. So again, if there's any lesson I take from my ancestry, it's that crises, as the explanation goes, and it's sometimes too naively cited, but crises, you know, are opportunities. And this crisis, the pandemic, certainly is an opportunity to rethink our role in nature and our own resilience, not just the resilience of natural systems, but human resilience. We underestimate ourselves as well as overestimating our intellectual capabilities.
But also looking at who we are, where we've come from. And that brings us back to our genes, our ancestry, and understand that there's this deep human wisdom. We're not all born with total ignorance. We actually, and we know that, you know, there are people who are child geniuses. And where do they get that? You know, and it's like so many of us are actually following the patterns of our ancestry unbeknownst to us. And that happened to you. All of a sudden, your ancestry showed up at your door. You know, it knocked on your door and it said, pay attention. And maybe that's true for all of us in different ways that we can learn from. What, you know, and maybe there are spirits of our ancestors out there that are moving it along too and trying to be helpful to us.
I think you're absolutely right. It was, you know, John Locke, the great Scots philosopher, one of the people who inspired our founding fathers, who came up with this notion of tabula rasa, that we're born with a blank slate, you know, a consciousness and a brain. You know, there's just nothing there. It's an unprogrammed computer. And you know, that has been the foundation of modern education for, well, several centuries now. And unfortunately, if modern education assumes that there is nothing there to respond to what is being taught, or if there is not already wisdom, as you said, of ancestors imprinted in our DNA, then modern education tells us not to listen to those whispering voices of ancestors or those whispering voices of intuition that tells us to do the uncommon, non-commonsensical, unorthodox thing, when reason tells us to go down a path of self-destruction, but intuition is saying, don't go there, it's dangerous, don't go there, it's stupid, don't go there, it's harmful. So we have to back up, and as I say in the book, we have to learn to take down the gates or the barriers to allowing our own intuition, our own ancestral memories that are encoded in our DNA and RNA, and the voices of our ancestors that I have experienced and discovered, who come knocking gently and sometimes not so gently on the door saying, hey, wake up, got something to tell you and you better listen.
I love that. And I think we need to think about that a lot more in being receptive and being maybe empty vessels of a being who is filled with ancestors, but we need them to come and fill us up.
The trick to doing this is to have patience. I've heard several radio programs recently where people ask a Native American, so how do I do it? How do I go out and have this kind of experience? You know, I went out and talked to the berry bush and I felt really stupid and it didn't say a thing. And I mean, I actually love honest feedback and questions like that, because that's what people are trying to do. And you know, the Native American who was being asked this question really didn't know how to respond, and I might not have. It took me several hours to think of the appropriate response. And the appropriate response is, you don't go out and you don't demand an answer. You go out into the garden or into the park or the forest or the potted plant on the window, and you quietly listen and you look. And much of the time you'll be greeted with silence, in which case you just look and learn what you can from observation. Then there are those rare and beautiful moments when it is, as I wrote in my book, it's as if the plant. It's as if the forest or the hawk that I saw perched on the fence as I drove home today, it's as if they are saying, Randy, I've got a message for you. And then you go on and you say, so what's the message? And you realize it was something you were thinking about. It was an insight that you had that was lurking beneath the surface of your consciousness. And what Mother Nature and our kin, our natural kin, are telling us is, go with it. It's right. That's where the wisdom is. That's the path forward. So the messages are subtle. You don't hear voices. You don't have a burning bush. At least I haven't. You have to listen with extraordinary patience.
Right. It's an internal knowing that you can receive.
Yes. Yes.
And that's beautiful. But that's also about being receptive to internal knowing that you don't know why you know what you know, but it came from somewhere. and so this is so wonderful to talk with you. It's because you've really explored your openness to these, you know, all these factors coming into your life and what they mean and how to hold perspective on who you are in relationship to your ancestors, in relationship to the environment, and are coming up with great ideas. And it's so wonderful to talk with you about that. So we're getting to the end of the show. And your book is called Without Reservation, and you are Randy Kritkowski, Kritkausky. Are there blogs or websites? Or
I have an author website. It's myname.com, and on it I list a variety of links to other websites that I've operated in my lifetime and spinoffs of my current writing.
That's great. It's, I'm so happy that we can climb into such a deep discussion about so many aspects of this. It's really great talking with you, Randy.
Thank you for having me on, and be well, and let's get on the healing path on our own little bodily afflictions this year and in our societal afflictions.
Right.
And see if we can move forward together.
That's wonderful. Thanks so much, Randy.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.